Today's the day I want to continue on the series I'm slowly doing over a year, one Monday a month, on the perfections. There are 10 perfections, what's called in Pali paramis is the word. In Sanskrit it's paramitas. And these are 10 qualities, strengths of character, inner qualities, that are understood to be very important supports or aids in the person's process of moving towards liberation and in the process of responding to the world through compassion. The word parami or paramita comes from the word, the root of the word is para, and para means other. That's all it means, just kind of ordinary word for other. And by inference or by extension, it refers to the other shore. This shore and the other shore, and part of the point of liberation, or liberation is a process of crossing the floods, crossing the somehow the rapids of the currents of greed, hate, and delusion, and coming to the other shore where we're on dry, hard ground, where we're not going to be caught up in the whirlwinds and the swirls of addictive behavior or reactive behavior or attachment clinging. And so paramita, with that kind of root, are those qualities that help in that process of making it across the floods or across these currents, the rapids. And sometimes they're called perfections because of that which takes you to the other shore. And the idea is once you get to the other shore, you've perfected the process of crossing the river or crossing the stream or whatever. So sometimes they're called the perfections. And they're not perfections in the sense that you have to develop these 10 qualities to the absolute capacity the human being can develop them, but you have to develop them to the point that they aid you to get across. Like if you want to build a raft to get across a river, you don't have to build a catamaran or a trimaran or, you know, hovercraft or something really complicated. You just have to build something that is good enough to get across the other shore. And so that's kind of these qualities. You don't develop these qualities to that kind of point. However, since the part of the function of the paramis is to help us in the compassionate service to others, it could be argued that there's no limit then to how much they can be developed because there's no limit to beings that need our help. So that 10 perfections are generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, and then the one for today, which is effort or energy. And this is followed then by patience. And then truth, determination or resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. And so we're about halfway through the list. And today is the day for the perfection of effort or energy. It's a little bit hard to know how to translate the word virya into English. Sometimes it's translated into English as effort, sometimes as energy, sometimes as vigor, sometimes as persistence, sometimes as heroic energy. The word virya, which is used here, comes from the root vira, which in Sanskrit and Pali refers to a hero. So it's kind of the idea of a heroic effort or energy is a little bit kind of in the background of this word, virya. And if you just translate it into English as energy or effort, you lose the sense of kind of, this is something, you know, that a hero needs, someone who's going to heroic effort. I kind of like the idea lately of translating as vigor, as a nice kind of way. Another possibility is vitality. So infusing our activities with vigor or vitality, energy, effort. Now, energy or effort in practice is important because there is no Buddhist practice, at least. I was going to say spiritual practice, but I can't speak for all spiritual traditions. But there is no Buddhist practice without effort. And some people limit their effort to reading the menu. And that certainly takes some effort, but it doesn't take enough to get you across. You can't read the instructions of how to build the boat and think that you'll get across. You have to actually build the boat and get in the boat and get across. So you have to apply. You have to kind of, you know, apply ourselves, engage somehow or other in the practice. The effort of applying ourselves in practice is multifaceted or quite varied. There's many different kinds of effort and energy that a person can undertake as they involve in Buddhist practice. Different phases of practice, different points in practice, different aspects of things we're addressing and dealing with require different kinds of effort and energy. And what this means is that someone who wants to engage in Buddhist practice has to be able to marshal or call upon or activate their ability to do, to act, to have effort, to engage. And they have to also monitor their effort so that it's the right kind in the given situation. Otherwise, they're going to get in trouble. Now, one of the ways of learning how to use effort, the best way that I know, unfortunately, is not having anyone tell you what the right effort is in practice, but rather each person learns on their own. And the way we learn, the way I learned, was through trial and error. And the unfortunate thing about trial and error is that it requires a lot of error. And some people have a very low capacity for error, for mistakes. And one of the things that's required, I believe, for successfully following the Buddhist path is a high capacity for error. So you can learn from that. So you learn from trial and error. You learn what works and what doesn't work. You learn what doesn't work by trying it. And so in my own practice, there's always a little, you know, not always, but there are these corrections that go on with effort, with energy. I'm making too much effort. Now I'm being too lazy or too complacent. And now I need to kind of make more, and now I need to make less. Kind of finding the balance of where the effort needs to be. Now the effort I need to make is to not make any effort at all. And it takes a lot of effort to stop making effort. And if I think that I can just stop making effort without making the effort to stop making effort, I'm sometimes fooling myself. And I have to be very persistent, very on top of things, to watch all the little tricks of the mind. The mind is so tricky sometimes, or so tenacious, to be involved in trying to do things. And sometimes you have to be very attentive to the mind, so to let go of the tendency of the mind to be doing, 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 doing. Sometimes that's the right effort to be made. There's a whole range of ways to apply effort. One of the ways of looking at the Buddha's teachings, or some of you know this, he has a lot of lists. And one of the ways of understanding the lists is that the Buddha is looking at the human being as something like an ecological field, like an ecosystem. And an ecosystem is a complex field of interactions. You have different elements in the ecosystem that interact in different ways. And there are different kind of balances they come into. And you don't understand the ecology of the San Francisco Bay by only understanding something about the water of the bay, or only about, you know, one different aspect. It's a complex field of interactions. Well, the human being is a complex field of many different factors, psychological, physical, you know, all kinds of mental factors that come into play. And so these lists, different lists the Buddha have, is kind of his way of trying to show how these different factors work together, support each other, interact, and develop the person. So if you look at effort and energy, we see that effort and energy is something that is interactive with other aspects of the human field that who we are. And so you can see that in some of the lists that the Buddha has. There's one list where virya, this word for energy, appears, where effort appears after confidence. It follows in sequence after developing confidence, or sometimes translated as faith in the five faculties. And so the presentation of the list there is that based on confidence, then there can be effort and energy. And I think most of us know this, that when there's a lot of confidence, that tends to come along with the rousing of energy and effort. It's a lot easier to do something if you have a lot of confidence in what you're going to do. And so confidence is one of the factors that feeds into having a healthy sense of energetic involvement or engagement in the practice we're doing. Classically in Buddhism, it said one of the things that's very important to have confidence in is in liberation. Is in the liberation, the awakening of the Buddha. And this is very clear when we're talking about the perfections, because the perfections are pointing towards, very explicitly, towards awakening, towards liberation. So it's not, you know, there's many ways of understanding Buddhist practice and how to apply it in daily life. But here we're looking at how is it these practices and these qualities support this very radical movement towards liberation. And having confidence in the Buddha's liberation, or confidence in, so that's one thing, that it's really something. The other thing is to have confidence in our capacity to move in that direction. And that's, you know, not so easy. There's different people have different sense of personal confidence in their ability to accomplish things, to master things. And that's also a very complicated aspect of human psychology. The self-perception we have, how we see ourselves as someone who can accomplish things and do things. And it has to do with our past experiences, it has to do with the messages we get from our society and models we have for what's possible. It has to do with our capacity for patience, our capacity for you know, many, many different things come into how we see ourselves as someone who can accomplish things or do things in this world. And it's not a fixed thing. Our sense of confidence in ourselves is not something we're born in, but something gets created over time, and it can be changed and worked with and developed. One of the ways of developing confidence is to develop it in small steps. So if you think that you have to kind of, you know, leave tonight fully enlightened, it's probably a little bit too big of a step to expect right now, maybe. But if you, perhaps what you're going to do tonight, maybe, is, you know, maybe before you go to bed tonight, you know, master your capacity to follow 10 breaths, or 5 breaths, or 1 breath. To really master something small. It turns out that one of the ways a human being develops confidence is in their capacity, is in small steps of mastery. In small steps of mastery, it also turns out that if it's too easy to master something, that it doesn't feed back to developing confidence in oneself. That's bad news, right? It means it has to be difficult. There has to be some effort and challenge involved in order to feel like we're mastering something, in order to kind of change our sense of personal confidence in ourselves. It has to be kind of tough, a little bit. So a small step, but something that's a little bit challenging, is what kind of feeds back in developing greater confidence in oneself. The other thing to have confidence in is in the practices we're doing. To have some confidence in the practice we're going to follow is a practice that works for us, that's going to take us where we want to go. In the context of the perfections, going to take us to enlightenment. Now, confidence is not meant here to be kind of a neutral thing. Oh yeah, you have to have kind of believe in it all so you can kind of do it. Confidence is actually something supposed to infuse a person with energy. That's why energy follows confidence in this list. That's part of the ecology of effort or energy, is having confidence. In another list, what feeds into effort or energy, virya, is what's called in English it's translated as investigation of dharmas. In another place they talk about discernment, the use of wisdom. And this is where you use your capacity to understand and to be discerning, to be discriminating what's going on, to distinguish between useful and unuseful things to do, helpful and unhelpful things to do. This very simple pragmatic concern is a very important aspect of early Buddhist teachings, the simple pragmatism of what works and what doesn't work. And so to be able to track that and watch it, okay, this works, this doesn't work. This quality, this state of mind is not helpful. This state of mind is helpful. If I spend a lot of time watching television, it doesn't seem to be very helpful in terms of developing the qualities that need to be had in order to be, in order to have the proper vigor to engage in a spiritual practice. I know sometimes when I watch television, I felt drained afterwards. So to see that, to know that, to have the ability to investigate one's own experience, or the honesty to investigate, this works and this doesn't work. Very simple thing. That is said to help strengthen or arouse the energy factor, that ability to be discerning and discriminating. In the list of the 10 perfections, energy, vigor, follows wisdom. And part of the reason for this is it's said in the tradition that energy helps perfect wisdom. When you have a wise understanding about something, it's the one thing to understand. It's something else than to really kind of live that. And you need energy to live the wisdom that you have. But also the wisdom is what gives you a sense of how to use the energy wisely. What is wise and useful energy? Where the energy should be channeled? There's a lot of different things we can do in human life with our energy, with our precious vitality. And not all of them are as effective for reaching liberation as others. And so have the wisdom to know what is useful and what is not. Part of that wisdom factor is to sort through all the myriad of things a human being can do. And let's just leave some of it out and say, sort through all the useful things to do in life, all the nice things to do in life. And there's a lot of good things to do in the world. There's a lot of causes to work for. There's a lot of good things to do. There's a lot of wonderful things to do. And some people here in the West are plagued with too many opportunities, too many choices. And we get kind of depressed or upset or split or scattered. You know, how do we deal with them all? And part of a wise life is knowing how to sort through all the different things a human being can do, and then to choose, to narrow the area, to choose maybe one or two or three things that are really important for us, that this is what we're going to put our time and energy into, so that we can perfect it. Now, in terms of developing the perfections, something as lofty as liberation and awakening, I think it becomes really crucial to start making some kind of wise decisions about how we're going to align our life after that goal. Not everyone has to have that goal, but that's a theme of this series. So I can say it now. So to really kind of sort through it all and realize you can't do it all. We can't do all the good things out there. There has to be some kind of narrowing of the field so that we can then have our energy go productively and usefully and in a concentrated way into this one thing that we're going to do, perhaps. In what's called the Eightfold Path, another list that the Buddha had, there the effort factor follows after developing ethics, being virtuous, developing right speech, right action, right livelihood. And one of the things the Buddha said is that a factor or support for energy, having energy or vigor or vitality available, is to present yourself to, he said to your teacher, but to anyone, I suppose, to present yourself unfraudulently, undeceitfully. Basically, be true to who you are. Don't try to hide or pretend you're something different or be defensive or kind of build up a front, but to really be honest about who you are. So this idea of honesty and virtue, of being, developing a certain level of virtue, is one of the things that helps bring support the availability of a good kind of effort and energy to engage in the spiritual life. Making sense so far? So now I can say that in the teachings of the Buddha, effort, in the early Buddha, the early teachings of the Buddha, effort is really important. So important that you have quotes like this. It is for you to make strong effort. The Buddhas only tell you how. They give you the menu or the recipe. You have to make the bread. You have to engage in the practice. The Dharma is for those who are industrious, not for those who are lazy. And then, a very short little quote that may be a little bit surprising for the way some people relate to Dharma practice or think about it. It's a dangerous quote, because if you understand this the wrong way, you'll end up getting a headache. Or if you try applying it in the wrong way. But it says, be quick in making effort. Be quick in making effort. Don't waste your time. Another quote that goes back now 2,500 years, that's still used to this day in the Zen monasteries, a slight variation of this. As if your head's on fire, live mindfully. As if your head... Now, what is that supposed to look like? The image of someone who's mindful is someone who's very peaceful and tranquil and going ahead and just very attentive. But someone whose head's on fire is not that way. I think it's not a good image, I think, even though it's used all the time. Because it's a little bit kind of... But the idea is that to really be aroused, to be really energized and really not waste time is the image here. Don't waste time. And don't waste time being peaceful. So vigor, energy, effort. It's one of the great pleasures that I know of in Dharma practice is when the vitality factor, when there's a sense of vitality, strong vitality, that arises from doing the practice itself. There's something, there's many ways of having vitality. I can go out and go for a long run and come back feeling energized in a nice way. And I'm not going to disparage that kind of energy. But there's something about that energy which lends itself, to, for me at least, of kind of... it's kind of like being a little bit too high, or a little bit too energized, or excited, or something. And or you can get, energized by having a lot of caffeine. But it also kind of leaves a kind of buzz, a kind of little edge to it, which doesn't, feel so good. But the kind of vitality that I've felt through meditation practice, when it kind of kicks in, comes in, that is not the same thing as my efforting, but I have to make effort for the vitality to arise. Like you can run, go running, and the running is required for the juices to get flowing, but you can't make the juices yourself flowing. It's kind of like the function of the running, right? So the same thing with meditation. When the meditation is going really well, really strong, there's this vitality, this energy that gets arises within. And a person can feel very, very, kind of sense of tremendous dynamism within. And that's usually not the popular image of meditation. The popular image of meditation is being really calm and peaceful. And some people are really pushing the calm factor when they meditate. And sometimes if you push it too much, you fall asleep. But calm and tranquility are very important parts of meditation. However, so is a tremendous sense of vitality. And these things can wonderfully coexist. And that's why if you're only focusing on calm and tranquility, you might be shortchanging yourself from the possibility of this vitality arising. And the vitality, the image of the vitality I like, is that of a candle flame that is burning unflickeringly. There's no wind blowing on it. Just a candle flame is completely still, in a sense. It's just this flame that's kind of going up from the candle. It doesn't move, it's just still. It's basically still. But you know that inside is tremendously dynamic. but it's, you know, it doesn't move because there's no wind blowing it. So the same thing with this energy that can arise in practice is a vitality that feels very kind of, sometimes some people use the word adamantine for the feeling of energy that can arise when people practice. One of the reasons why we do walking meditation on retreats is so that there can be a proper availability of effort or energy for the meditative process. If people just sit and meditate all day, that tends to be soporific, just sitting all the day. The energy kind of drains. People need to go back and forth, alternating between the right balance of walking meditation and sitting meditation, and the walking what brings energy. Back in the time of the Buddha walked a lot because he didn't have any cars. And he had to walk every day to go for his alms, to get his food. He walked around much of northern India to teach and meet people. And he, up until the time he was 80 years old, he was walking hundreds of miles. And he trekked, you know, from the foothills of the Himalayas all the way down to near Patna. It's kind of a good walk, 80-year-old man, to walk across northern India like that. And I say this because the Buddha had my good guess is the Buddha could never have imagined that there was going to be a generation of people who communicated to each other through tapping on little plastic squares. And that they'd be slumped over, hunched over, on looking at these white, these luminous screens, and just sitting around all day. Or some people sit around other ways. And because he could never imagine it, because he lived in a culture maybe that did a lot of walking, and people tend to be more fit perhaps, the Buddha neglected to mention the importance of exercise. The Buddha has his Eightfold Path. Well, I think that if he lived in our society here, he would have come up with a Ninefold Path. And probably would have been right exercise. Because a certain level of vigor, vitality, is really important for the meditative process to go really well. And so the body has to be somewhat tuned, not too much and not too little. There's actually warnings of not being too fit. You know, like governors. Being free from illness and discomfort, endowed with good digestion, not too cold, not too hot, of moderate strength, fit for exertion. There was somewhere else, there was a quote about not being too fit. I forget where that was. But this is one of the factors for effort, is being physically fit. And now there's examples of people who became awakened while they were sick. But having, you know, when we have the ability to kind of keep our body toned, this is a really important aspect, support for meditation practice. Now, when people have barely any time at all, and you can barely squeeze in meditation or squeeze in a little bit of exercise, then it's really hard to have sometimes a balanced life. And that's why the discerning aspect of our life, being discerning and wise about our priorities, is really important, because sometimes we have to have behavioral change in order to have the proper amount of time to live a balanced life that supports perhaps a spiritual life. One important teaching the Buddha gave, one place it appears is in the Eightfold Path, the definition and explanation of right effort there. Right effort is defined as being fourfold, or one translator translated as the right endeavors. These are four, since there's so many things we can do with our effort or energy, these are four areas to help make it a little bit easier for us. And that is to make the effort to abandon, to let go of unhelpful states of mind that are here. To make the effort to prevent unhelpful states of mind from arising. Make the effort to arouse helpful states of mind that are not around right now. And then make the effort to maintain and develop those helpful states of mind which are present. So it's abandoning, avoiding, developing, and maintaining are the four different kinds of effort. So this requires the ability to be mindful and wisely discerning, to be able to track and monitor what the effect is on us of having different states of mind or different kinds of thoughts, or different kinds of feelings, what's going on, and have the ability to work with it. Sometimes you can work with it on a very large scale. If you read, if you read horror books or see horror movies regularly, you know, and you wonder why you're always feeling kind of afraid, you know, and you look at everybody wondering, if that person's safe, you know. Maybe the simple ways of avoiding a certain amount of fear, the arising fear, is to stop reading those horror books. You know, making that level of decision, you know, could be helpful. And then there's much more subtle ones, and that is tracking our mind, or even our thoughts. What thoughts? Thoughts can have a tremendous impact on our well-being, in the moment even. Having a certain train of thought can drain our energy. Other kinds of thoughts can vitalize our energy. And to be able to track that and watch that, sometimes it's appropriate to say, not enough of this. Say, enough of this. I'll let go of this kind of thinking. It's not useful. It's not productive. It's not helpful. Or you know that something's not useful to you, and so you try to avoid what's going to arouse it. If you know that thinking about, dreaming about having, I don't know what, you know, some wonderful consumer product, and every time you open certain magazines, you spend the next 2 days fantasizing about having this consumer product, and nothing else happens in your life because you're just fantasizing about how to get it. You know, that's not a useful thing to do. I think I better not look at that magazine because I don't want to have that triggered in my mind. Or to appreciate there are helpful states of mind. There are states of mind like loving kindness, or peace, or tranquility, or wisdom, patience. There's qualities like concentration or mindfulness. These are useful things to have, to be present for us. How can they be cultivated? How can they be developed? How can they be maintained and enhanced when they're there? So some of you have decided to come here tonight. And I imagine that's because you felt that being mindful or meditative was going to be helpful. And you thought this would be a helpful place to cultivate and develop that, maybe to arouse it. Some of you maybe had a busy day, busy life. And so this kind of stops it all and kind of gets you to sit in a way that maybe you couldn't do at home. So that's a choice. Or you're going to see someone you have a difficult relationship with, and you think, well, you know, I think a good way of preparing for that is I think I'll do a little bit of loving kindness meditation or practice so that I come with a little bit more helpful state of mind for that interaction than I would otherwise. So I'm going to arouse that state of mind, maintain it, and develop it. So this process of monitoring ourselves and making adjustments and working on ourselves is one of the teachings the Buddha gave us. They said it was very important to do. Just like exercising the body, it's helpful to exercise the mind or the heart and be able to have that ability, that strength or that capacity to be able to move things about in the inner life. Some people who have never exercised the inner life have no ability to move things or work with things or let go or bring things up, evoke things. But if you start doing this in small steps, you'll find with the practice that you'll get more and more skillful at working with your inner life. And you don't have to take things as being fixed, this is the way it is. But you can actually work with it and change it, just like you would with exercise. It's not any different. The danger of this is that a person can get the impression that this Buddhist spiritual life is all about tinkering. And there's a place for tinkering or working, but it's kind of a dead end if you're always tinkering, adjusting, doing this and that. Sometimes what's necessary is, at some point, it's necessary to realize we have to let go of all efforts, let go of all attempts to build or construct or maintain, or even let go of the effort to let go. Just develop complete presence for what is. No need to go forward, no need to go backwards, no need even to stand still. Just presence in the midst of whatever is going on. And perhaps in that peacefulness of presence, anytime there's a movement away from it, sometimes we just let go. We let go. So the teaching of letting go can be one where we learn to persistently let go. We energetically let go, to let go back into the peace. And then sometimes we don't want to even let go, but the practice is to energetically let be. Let things be, let things be. There's a time and place for different ways of practicing. A lot depends on what's going on in the ecology of the mind. When the inner ecology is in homeostasis, that's the time for making no effort at all. There might be a lot of vitality, but there's no need anymore to be for anything or against anything. There's no need to try to make something happen or not make something happen. But when the system is not in homeostasis, right, not in balance, then we need to somehow bring it into balance. And depending on how far out of balance it is, depends a lot what kind of effort is needed. When someone is wildly out of balance because of their ethical conduct, maybe they have to spend a heroic amount of time getting their ethical conduct cleaned up. Ask for forgiveness. Practice atonement or do something. But when their ethical life is basically harmonious, then that effort's not needed, but maybe something else is needed to bring things into balance. But when the ecology of the human psyche is in balance, it's described in the early tradition as being in a state of equanimity. And when the equanimity is strong, then the mind realizes that it doesn't have to cling or react to anything. And when you can't convince the mind that, you can't tell the mind that. But when the mind comes to the point where it realizes by itself, because of all this equanimity, that it doesn't need to be for anything or against anything, holding on to anything whatsoever, then the mind lets go of itself. Now, why would you want the mind to let go of itself? When the mind lets go of itself, then it reaches the other shore. And then it's awake. So, it takes a little effort. And I hope that all of you are willing to do the trial and error work of finding the right effort in different times. And it's a learning process. And remember that if things are too easy, you don't develop your confidence. People who have a high degree of confidence in their ability to accomplish things will interpret failure as a sign that either they didn't make enough effort or they didn't have the right knowledge or skills to accomplish something and they just need to develop those. People who have a very low level of self-confidence when they fail, they just simply say, they come to the conclusion, I don't have the ability. I hope all of you will find how to have tremendous confidence in your ability to accomplish your own self-efficacy. And in having that confidence, be able to make... the other thing, people who have a high degree of confidence in their ability to accomplish something tend to put higher goals for themselves than people who have low confidence in themselves. So my hope for all of you is that you have a high confidence in your ability and that you practice the persistence, which is one of the ways of translating this word virya, persistence to try and try again and not be afraid of failing and failing and failing and failing. This is a little, maybe not a good footing to end on, but it's been... James Joyce, when he submitted the Dubliners to the publishers, it was rejected by 22 publishers. There's an example. There's a whole series of people who were rejected for their endeavors, sometimes for years and decades, but they just kept at it, working on it. They believed in it. They worked on it. Continued and continued working on it. Rejection and failure don't need to be reasons to give up. Rejection and failure is just a sign that we need to make more effort. Hang in there. And a lot of things can be... And with enough effort, we'll all get to home to bed. Well, okay. So thank you all very much.